My picture of the salt that will go along with the lesson tonight may be a little optimistic. I may not get to that part of it, but we'll see, you know, how we do. I do appreciate your presence. I appreciate the prayer. And something that was said in the prayer is the application. We have to understand, and this applies to any Bible passage, what did it mean when it was written? What did it mean, you know, for example here, what did it mean to a first century saint in Colossae? First, you know, you understand that, then you can begin to make the proper application to yourself and to, you know, to the 21st century. If we try to first make it fit the 21st, I think sometimes we get it wrong. We get it out of the context. But keep the context. And in chapter 3, we have come to what, you know, sometimes we might call the practical section. But I want to remind you, verses 1 through 4, this is all based on our relationship to Christ. Christ, the one that in the first and second chapters, he has shown us his exalted nature, this eternal nature of Christ, and how wonderful he is, and what he did for us in the body of his flesh, at the cross. And so he says in verse 1, if then you are raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Make no mistake about it, he specifies some areas of conduct that are some that are forbidden, some that are required. But it starts, and it all has to be based off of a mindset. That when we were, as you go back to the second chapter, 11 through 13, when we were baptized, the old man died. And what comes forth is a new man living in Christ. Christ, he said, is our life. My life's hidden. You don't even see me anymore, he says. You know, that's got to be our approach. That our mind, our affections are set above. We're going to live life in husband-wife relationships, parent-child relationships. Tonight we'll be talking about master-servant. Yeah, we live all of those. But what's our focus? Our focus ought to be above. It ought to be on the Christ and his return, which will be glory for us. Now, what does this mean? Well, there are things to put away. Verse 5, put to death. That's a strong term. You know, don't play around with these sins. Put them to death. And then he changes his wording, his, you know, the comparison to say, put off, put on. There's an old man, like you would take off a coat, just shed that garment and put on a new man that is like Christ. And in verses 12 through 14, he gives us some of the qualities of that new man. And then we talked about last week, verse 15, 16, and 17. You let the peace of God rule in your heart. You let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. You do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus. You want him to be glorified. And that brings us to relationships. How do I live as a husband, as a parent, a child? You know, how do I live? Well, I live it based on the fact that my life is supposed to be hidden with Christ in God. That whatever I do in any of those relationships is to be done in his name, at his direction, to his glory. And what does he call on wives to do? Submit. Husbands, love them and don't be what? Bitter or harsh toward them. Then he says, children, do what? Obey. And then he says, fathers, and remember the word fathers here can, well, sometimes use, like we might use man to speak of, you know, the inclusive parents. They were not to do what? Provoke their children because of the concern that what would happen? They become discouraged. You don't want to break their spirit. Well, then he turns to bondservants. And this is the one that to me is interesting. And I made mention of this last week. You compare Ephesians 5, 6 with Colossians 3 going into the first verse of chapter 4. And if anybody, you know, this is one of those you go, when they finally got around to dividing the Bible up into chapters, what were they thinking when they, you know, broke the chapter 4, you know, and started it? One verse of the continuing discussion he carries into the fourth chapter. And that's not, you know, Paul didn't write it in chapters. He wrote it as one letter. But Ephesians 5 and 6, the wives, the husbands, the children, the fathers, much longer in Ephesians. The only relationship in Colossians that he spends a comparable amount of time on is this bondservant-master relationship. And I think we ought to, as we're reading and we notice that kind of difference, I'll say, well, why would that be? Well, first of all, I'm speculating, but not completely. Look at the fourth chapter of this book. And I want you to take note of something. And we'll be looking at this, Lord willing, next week in more detail. But he says, Tychicus, a beloved brother, faithful minister, and fellow servant in the Lord, will tell you all the news about me. I am sending him to you for this very purpose, that he may know your circumstances and comfort your hearts, with Onesimus, a faithful and beloved brother, who is one of you. They will make known to you all things which are happening here. Okay, two men are being sent from Rome to Colossae, Tychicus and Onesimus. What do we know about Onesimus from the book of Philemon? He was a runaway slave. Who was his master? Philemon. Where'd Philemon go to church? you've got this letter that's being carried by these two men. One of them is a runaway slave who belonged to a man that's a member of the church at Colossae. So, you know, that would make this an important subject in that church. But also the fact that slavery was so widespread in the first century. It was going to be an issue anywhere. You see it referenced in 1 Corinthians 7. You know, where he tells them, you know, if you can be free, be free. But if not, you know, just you have to glorify God there. 1 Peter 2. We're going to talk about it later. It was very common. One estimate, and it was, you know, estimates vary a little, but one estimate said that at the height of the Roman Empire, 40% of the people living in Italy were slaves. In fact, one writer said that somebody got the idea of having the slaves wear special clothing that would identify them as slaves. Because, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, but you know, the slaves in their physical appearance didn't look any different than anybody else. And so somebody had the idea, you know, they ought to look like slaves. And then before they implemented the idea, some smarter people realized, wait a minute. If all these slaves start seeing how many of them there are, there's going to be a rebellion. So they decided it was just better if slaves didn't realize who all was slaves. That was one of the issues in the first century. And when you think about first century servitude, one thing that makes it very different than how, you know, we had it in this country, there was no racial component at all to their slavery. You know, they enslaved anybody they could capture in war. You know, that was their number one source of slaves, is the people they defeated in war. You know, and they fought with the Greeks from time to time. And I'm going to say more about that in just a second. It's interesting. But there are also sometimes people made the decision to sell themselves into slavery. You know, you think, well, why would anybody do that? Well, sometimes they were so poor, they had no way to feed themselves, and so they would agree to become a slave and work for free in order to have food and clothing. You know, how many of you ever asked your parents, you did some job, and you said, am I going to get paid for this? And they gave you the old, you get paid three times a day, you know, that kind of answer. There were people that did. There were people who sometimes sold in desperation, would sell their children into slavery. Sometimes the servitude was only for a time. You will notice, if you're reading the New King James, it says bond servants. If you're reading the English Standard, it'll say slave. There were people who, because of debt, they were forced into, you know, the term we use today in history books today would be indentured servitude. You know, you had to serve this master for a certain period of time to pay off a debt. Once the debt was paid off, you were freed. That was something that happened. But there was also freedom. It was often granted because of a master sometimes just appreciated the good work somebody had done for him for a number of years and said, you know, you've earned your freedom. Or, you know, sometimes, you know, if a man's work slowed down a little bit, it was easier to just set him free, let him go, and, you know, wait on the next batch of prisoners to be captured in war. You ever notice in Acts, the sixth chapter, verse 9, the synagogue that Stephen had his disputes with, where it all started? Then there arose some from what is called the synagogue of the freedmen. Those are ex-slaves. There were enough of them, they formed their own synagogue there in Jerusalem. Well, what was life like for a slave? Well, some were good. Some had it pretty good. Some had it terrible. 1 Peter 2:18. I want you to take note of this one because we want to tie it in as we look at how a servant then was to act. And I think if when we begin to understand how servants were to act, then we can make some application to us as employees. If we understand how masters were to act, we can make some application to us as owners, managers, you know, whatever. But he says, servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. Now, an interesting note here. The word servant in 1 Peter 2 is a different word than is used by Paul in Colossians 3. The word that's used here had the idea of a domestic servant. There were servants that did much crueler work than them. But notice what he said, the good and gentle and the harsh. There were some masters that treated their servants with dignity and respect, and there were others that were harsh. There were some who, as he will go on to say, verse 20, would beat them. And the life of a slave, it varied. A domestic generally was in better condition than, you know, you were captured in the war and you were sold to somebody that owned a mine. Mining is dangerous work. even to this day, with all the OSHA regulations and things, you know, you still occasionally hear of the collapse in a mine. You know, those things, that was dangerous. But educated Greeks, you know, they were sometimes more educated than the Romans that captured them in war. They were trained, and they would work as accountants, as teachers. They were professionals. They just didn't get paid for it, you know, and they were under a master that directed them, but they had a pretty decent life. Now, the question becomes, and this is a question I think a lot of people ask about the Bible. There just seems something wrong with the whole idea of owning another person as though it were just another piece of property. Why doesn't the New Testament come out and just say it's wrong to own people and treat them like property? You know, first of all, what kind of government did the first century Christians live under? A Roman dictatorship. You had no, I mean, they're not going to start a campaign to free the slaves. You didn't have that power. You didn't have that authority. And I'll just say more about what I think the answer to that question is in a moment. But as I've already said, there's application to be made to how we conduct ourselves on our jobs. Not every part of this would fit, but much of it would. And what does he tell bond servants? What are they told to do? Or slaves, if your translation puts it that way. What's the first word? Obey. Do what you're told. Do what you're told in what manner? In all things? Not with what? Eye service. Not what does it mean? Well, let me ask. If you work a slave, an employee of a company, and you do your work with eye service, what does that mean? You're busy when the boss is around, you know. And when he's not around, you know, you do what you want to do. That's he says, don't be that way. Now, you just think about, he is telling somebody, in some cases, they're working off a debt. But in most cases, these are people who are working without any compensation. He says, I want you to do this, not with eye service, not just trying to please man, but I want you to please God. And verse 23, you hear this quoted oftentimes, whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. And understand, this is first said to servants, to slaves. And, you know, I've told a story one time about having, as a child, we would often pull weeds out of soybean fields. They didn't drill them like they do now. And we had a neighbor that was hiring us boys. We were young. And I can't remember now if he started out was going to give us a dollar an hour. It may have been as low as 50 cents an hour, which was low, but we would do it. My two cousins at dinner the first night talked about getting in a dirt clod fight. And so their dad went to our neighbor and said, these boys don't deserve what you're paying them. And negotiated a pay cut down to 35 cents an hour. Okay, I know that was a long time ago. It was 50 years ago or so. I did not want to go to work the next day. In fact, my dad had to threaten me, that you're going to go to work. And did we work heartily when we realized that we would have to work 3 hours in the hot sun pulling weeds to earn a dollar and a nickel? Probably not. You know, but, you know, we were learning some valuable life lessons, I'm sure. but no, we were kids. And I'm probably 10 years old, 10, 11. You know, here is a grown adult who's somebody else's property. And he says, I want you to work because from the Lord you will receive the reward of your inheritance. Some masters were good and gentle. Some masters would appreciate the work that had been done and in time grant freedom. But not all did. Some worked until they died. He said, what do? You work as for the Lord, and He will bless you. The darker the circumstances we find ourselves in, the brighter our lights can shine. You know, and that's the lesson. I didn't know that lesson at 10 years old. Or if I knew it, I just didn't apply it. But you've got to do the right thing. And then look at verse 25. He who does wrong will be repaid for what he has done, and there is no partiality. Is he still talking just to the servant? I think this is his transition. In Ephesians, he puts that statement under the master's responsibilities. But here he puts it in kind of in between. It applies both ways. You don't do wrong. And that's the point he makes in 1 Peter 2. You may be mistreated. He said, you know what you ought to do? Be like Jesus. When he was mistreated, he committed himself to the judgment of God. You know, on a job, you know, none of us are going to have to work as slaves. But sometimes we find ourselves working for people that don't appreciate us. We find ourselves working for people that not only do they not appreciate us, they don't even treat us right. You know, I worked for a man one time that, I mean, his idea of getting more out of you was just screaming. You know, what do you do? Paul said you just work. You do your job like you want to do it for God, not to please him. Then he turns to the masters. And he says, what about you? Let me catch up here. He says, masters, and first of all, I was going to make a point. The instruction to masters is shorter, though it's pretty comprehensive in just a few words he gives. But there were probably a lot more slaves in first century churches than there were masters. Remember 1 Corinthians 1:26, not many mighty, not many powerful are called. You look at the book of James, and he consistently in the book of James, he portrays the rich as those who are the outsiders, the ones oppressing the Christians. The Christians tended to be on the poor end of it. But he says, masters, you give them what is just and fair. Do you see a certain irony in that? That you have taken possession of somebody and you are demanding of them they work for nothing. Paul says, I want you to give them what's fair. Slavery's never been based on the principle of giving people what's fair. He says, you give them what's fair. In Ephesians 6 and verse 9, he says, you give up threatening. When you begin to think about the demand that you treat people fairly, and justly. And we'll talk about this a little bit in Philemon, because I think we're going to have time to catch that before the end of the quarter. If you're a master and you have a slave that is a fellow member of the body, you know, first century, the more you think about this relationship in the body, these kind of qualities that belong to the new man, this love that is the bond of perfection, wouldn't you find it more and more difficult each day to get up and say, okay, you, my fellow heir of Christ, I want you to spend this day slaving in the hot sun for my benefit. Even if the man was not a fellow Christian, if you saw him as made in the image of God, you go, how do I hold him as property? You know, a piece of land, yeah. A cow, yeah. But I'm holding a fellow image bearer. What happens? And this is what we've got to see. It's all of our life. Is God works on hearts of people. God seeks to transform us from the inside out. To change the way I see people. The way I see myself. You know, the humility that he talks about putting on. You know, we live in a society that wants us to be concerned about exalting ourselves. God tells us to humble ourselves. He teaches them to love their neighbor as themselves. You know, if I can just learn to see people as made in the image of God, whether it be my boss or my worker or my neighbor or that cashier at the grocery store, whoever it may be, the more I see them as a fellow image bearer, you know, one that God created, one Jesus died for, it's going to change everything. And, I mean, what did Jesus say about the law and the prophets? It all hung on two things: loving God and loving your neighbor. Did he go on to specify some other things? Certainly. But he said that's the heart of the matter. If you get those two things right. We got about 3 minutes. Any thoughts, comments on any of that before I maybe catch another verse or two? You tell me.
Well, I mean, this is good. If we're going to get at this by changing hearts and minds, well, then let's put that in the history and put the letter of Philemon where Paul very lovingly but sneakily gets Philemon to take another look at his relationship with his slave.
And that's why I said I wanted him to answer, because I knew he was going to answer it better than I could, you know, ahead of time. I think that's exactly. And you read Philemon, and we want to talk about it more. But he really tries to get to the heart of Philemon, you know, to appeal to him and, you know, look to him in that way. Anybody else? Anything?
Never condemned. Stephen didn't condemn the Jews or the Romans. Now, Peter, of course, condemned them for putting Christ to death, but when they were released from prison, they went and washed the guy's stripes. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about their victimhood. It was about doing the right thing, regardless of what they were dealt with, whatever that was dealt to them or with them.
Mm-hmm. we must always do the right thing. I mean, and that is one of the principles that I think it is human nature. Let's be honest, it's a part of our American culture of the don't tread on me mentality. You know, and yet, look over there at 1 Peter. I've alluded to it a couple of times, but servants, be submissive to your masters. Not only the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. This is commendable, if because of conscience toward God one endures grief, suffering wrongly. For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. And then he gives us the example of Jesus. In chapter 3, verse 1, wives, likewise be submissive to your own husbands. I think that likewise is pointing us back to what he's just said. Not all husbands are going to heed the admonition to not be harsh. There will be some who are bad. What do? Well, he's just showed you. You act like Jesus. And that's my challenge. That's the challenge I face every day is, have I really hidden my life in Christ? Has Christ become my life? Or do I go about with the chip on my shoulder? You know, do I have the mentality of, you're not going to tread on me? You know, which mentality do I have? You know, that's the critical test that we must let Christ live in us, shine in us. We are out of time. Chapter 4 next week, we may not completely finish up the chapter, but we will get most of it next week. Leave ourselves a little time for Philemon.